Hello, podcast person, and you're a very special person if you're downloading this. Thanks for choosing this podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway, a program that's produced by WNYC and Public Radio International. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening. And listen here to the white mayor of New York City, married to a black woman with a mixed-race son, speaking to the people of his city.
It's a phrase that should never have to be said. It should be self-evident. But our history, sadly, requires us to say that black lives matter.
Black lives matter. Mayor Bill de Blasio last night seizes the one note of absolute clarity as once again the court system fills an American city with noisy confusion about race, law enforcement tactics, grand juries, and justice. As you heard, a grand jury in Staten Island voted not to issue an indictment in the death of Eric Garner, killed as the result of his chest being compressed and his neck held in a chokehold. That's according to the coroner last July. We begin with this Ferguson flashback in the Big Apple. This is what it sounded like on the streets of New York last night, ironically, as tourists watched the Christmas tree lighting across town at Rockefeller Center.
I'm disgusted and embarrassed by our New York City government and NYPD. Here's a man who has been in trouble several times before. He's not a newbie on the force. He's done this kind of thing before. People have sued because of this man, yet he remains on the force, an embarrassment to the men and women who are trying to do good.
Voices on the streets of New York talking about the Eric Garner case. Let's hear once again the voice of the widow of Eric Garner, who is astounded by the grand jury's decision yesterday not to indict the men who, on video, can be seen choking and on top of her husband last July in an arrest attempt that resulted in his death.
My husband's death will not be in vain. As long as I have a breath in my body, I will fight the fight to the end.
But what is the fight? Will the peace in New York City be sustained? That's something we can all be thankful for today. And what now? With me now in the studio, Brian Lehrer, host of The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, our producing partner, and Kai Wright, editor-at-large of Color Lines. Welcome to you both.
Hi, John. Hi, Kai.
So this is a huge sort of community issue in the city of New York. It raises issues across the nation. What do you think is the headline here, Brian?
Well, arguably, at the risk of being provocative, this is much worse than the Ferguson decision.
I agree.
I have already had multiple callers who say they actually came to support the Ferguson decision, given the facts, but are outraged by this case. In this case, you had a guy who was not being sought in a robbery, in hot pursuit. He was just a guy selling loose cigarettes on the street. He was not being aggressive with the police officers before his arrest. Like Michael Brown was trying to get Darren Wilson's gun, Garner was keeping his distance, arguing, pleading not to be arrested again for this small offense, a tax violation, really. He was not a flight risk. There was no suspicion that he was armed. The chokehold was against police policy. And as you just replayed, he was repeatedly saying on the ground, "I can't breathe, I can't breathe," and the officer did not ease up. These are arguably much worse facts than in Ferguson.
And those are, comments from people that spoke on your program last night, guests that you had on the program last night, and the details about what Michael Brown allegedly did came out of the grand jury proceeding there in Ferguson. We have no details of what came out of the grand jury hearing in Staten Island. This raises the question of how New York police deal with these minor offenses. That what you saw on that video, aside from the horrific death of Eric Garner, is the way cops aggressively deal with people who are apparently not doing much in the way of crime.
Yeah, and it's something that has been exported around the country, this idea that you respond big to small things and that's going to keep things from getting out of control. That was the idea. And I think, to note what one of the protesters said about Officer Pantaleo, who was the arresting officer who had the chokehold on Eric Garner, he was actually doing his job. WNYC has reported, he is a standout officer in terms of his number of arrests for small offenses. That's what cops do in a broken windows policing system. They go big on small offenses. And that's – Eric Garner had been arrested 8 times for selling 75-cent cigarettes. And so that kind of interaction continually – that kind of ongoing harassment leads to these bigger problems over and over and over again. And it's that idea that I think we really have to start talking
about. Did de Blasio address that in his speech last night, the question of we're going to change the way police deal with people?
Mayor de Blasio listed off a number of reforms, and I think what you're hearing is an idea that we can tweak this in the margins. There are things we can do to this policing idea that make it safer and that make it less aggressive. But he and Commissioner Bill Bratton did not challenge the national consensus now that effective policing means being really aggressive on small things, largely in black neighborhoods.
Now, this is going to sound, you know, maybe schmaltzy and weird, but my 15-year-old daughter last night came home in tears, hysterical over this decision.
Sure.
She says all of her best friends since she was like, you know, 7 are black. She didn't know how to talk to them. She didn't know what to say. She was, I mean, we had to sit her down and calm her down last night.
People all over America who have not seen the videotape should watch the videotape.
Yep.
And start to come to their own conclusions. I mean, one of the defenses that apparently is emerging that I guess the grand jury heard is that the officer believed that Garner could breathe precisely because he was saying he couldn't breathe, that if you can't breathe, you can't talk, repeating a phrase over and over again, I can't breathe. But it so goes against the emotion that anybody's going to feel and the perception that almost anybody's going to have watching that videotape. It's just something that everybody should see for themselves and come to their own conclusion.
And there's a systemic question here of how this video evidence conflicts with the process and, you know, the jury of the wider sort of community conflicts with whatever went on in that grand jury proceeding. I want to play some of the sentiments from the streets of Staten Island. WNYC reporter Kathleen Horan talked to people last night and heard outrage and endorsement of the grand jury decision. These are some people who see nothing about race or police brutality here.
If this police officer did not intend to hurt him, then I don't think an indictment should be brought, you know, down.
The cops on Staten Island are equal opportunity guys. They pull us all over. They harass all of us. I never get a break from them.
It's just like, you know, the cops tells you to put your hands in your back or whatever. You just do it. They have this notion that you could, you know, they could fight with everybody, you know. It doesn't work that way.
I feel that, you know, with this whole race stuff going on now, that if it was the guy was white and he was a white cop, that they wouldn't have blown this up as much as they did. I just think that because they're pulling this whole race card thing.
That's reporting from producing partner WNYC. Your team, Brian, really getting a sense from Staten Island that they're supporting this decision.
Well, we know that there is a massive difference between white perception and black perception in this country. Romney won whites by 20 points, even though Obama was elected pretty overwhelmingly in terms of electoral votes in this country and total votes. There is a massive, and Kai Wright, I don't have to tell you, there is a massively different perception among whites and blacks, and that's what we heard in that clip. The fact that Eric Garner was a large black man, I don't know if you can prove to a jury or grand jury that that was a factor in Officer Pantaleo's perception. It certainly looked like it was in Ferguson.
But this isn't about proof. It's about probable cause.
That's all that was required to move
probable
an indictment
cause.
For probable cause. But, I mean, you know, to on the question of perception, the reason why there's a huge difference in how black and white people perceive these issues is because there's a huge difference in how we have lived them. And experience with police officers. If you live in a black neighborhood in New York City, you have been witness to, you either have experienced it yourself or you have watched on a relatively routine basis NYPD harassing people over really small things in really aggressive ways. And so it is immediately resonant. When I watch Eric Garner's frustration in that video, it is immediately resonant to me. I don't think it doesn't seem at all strange that he would say, hey, listen, I'm sick of this. You bother me like this every single day.
But are you saying that whites in the city of New York look at that video and don't think, most of them, that there's probable cause to do something to those officers?
I don't know that you could look at that video and feel that way,
it's probable cause. It's like, yeah, something happened, folks. Explain it. The grand jury didn't do that.
But listen, I have stood in front of my subway stop and been told, move along. You can't stand here. it is inconceivable that I would be standing in front of a subway stop in Park Slope, a white neighborhood in Brooklyn, and be told that. I've never experienced that outside of my neighborhood. But if you don't live in that kind of neighborhood, you may have a different relationship
with police. But here's the other side of that perception. People, and more white people than black people, are going to give police officers the benefit of the doubt when they're doing their jobs and trying to protect the public and not intending to harm anyone, as the officer didn't seem to be intending to harm Eric Garner here. And then when a resist situation is taking place, as it was in Ferguson, but he was resisting, then accidents, tragic accidents like this might happen. That's the other argument.
But that was the crazy thing on your show last night. Somebody said it wasn't like he woke up and said, I'm going to go kill a black man today, as though that's the test. That if you just sort of are in the course of your job, kill a black man, it's okay if you're a cop. But if you decide in the morning when you wake up and put on your Ku Klux Klan hat, yes, or something, that's the test. That was driving me crazy on your show.
But as a matter of politics, that's what most of white America probably thinks is the test. Look at the Wall Street Journal editorial page today where they say the bottom line is a man was resisting arrest. He caused it.
And as a matter of policy, the officer did wake up and say, I'm going to do my job today, which is to go into the 120th precinct and find people to harass for petty crimes in really aggressive ways. That's what he did wake up to do. And if that is the policy, if that's what you're doing every day, eventually it's going to lead to dangerous confrontations.
Can we end on a process question here? Both of you are more sophisticated on this than I am. Is it possible that the Staten Island DA just basically did not want to deal with this, did not want to deal with all those people from Staten Island who are pro-cop and just wanted to punt this to Eric Holder and the feds, basically to have them take care of it?
Plainly, I don't think there's any from the prosecutor through the mayor. Everyone is very eager for the federal government to take control of this in New York City.
On the other hand, DA in Staten Island is an elected position. It's a largely white borough, more conservative than the rest of New York City. He thought that there should be no indictment. It was in his interest for there to be no indictment. And he led the grand jury in that direction, arguably.
Well, if this is a case that is certainly going to persist here in the city of New York, we are, of course, blessed with the peaceful reaction, but the protests, I think, will continue, and there will be many more consequences here. Brian Lehrer, host of The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Thanks, Brian.
Thanks, John.
And Kai Wright, always great to talk to you, editor-at-large at Color Lines.
Thanks.
There's a spanking new Congress from the midterm elections ready to convene in January, but still this Congress, on the way out, wants to pick another government shutdown fight with the president. President Obama announced he was going to go it alone on immigration policy and ordered a stop to deportations. Republicans like Ted Cruz aren't going to take it.
Just about every Republican candidate in the country campaigned saying, if you elect us, we will stop President Obama's amnesty. What I'm here urging my fellow Republicans to do is very, very simple. Do what you said you would do. Yeah!
But is this a battle the lame duck Congress is really ready for? Takeaway Washington correspondent Todd Zwillick. Welcome, Todd.
Hi, John.
So why do this fight now? Why get into this now? Why not wait till the Congress is actually convened? This is a lame duck set of legislators right now.
Well, lots and lots of people on the Hill, Republicans, are asking that very question. And here's really the answer to it. You know, once President Obama executed his immigration executive action, as we all know, a lot of Republicans and just about every conservative were enraged. They called it unconstitutional. They called Barack Obama a king or an emperor. And once you've branded the president a king or an emperor or said that his actions are completely unconstitutional, the next question is, how can you vote for anything that will continue it, even for a day? And that's why Republicans are having this fight now, even though the leadership, John Boehner and Mitch McConnell, wish they weren't.
Even though we should note that the Congress, the Republicans, had no problem with the sort of separation of powers questions raised by, you know, George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, you know, back in the last decade, right?
Well, sure, there's been a lot of snickering and kind of frustration about how time seems to erase people's political memories. But the most interesting part about this for me, John, is when you look at John Boehner's speakership, the history of it, you know, you can kind of map this history of all the times when Speaker Boehner has had to kind of come up with a legislative gambit, or even for another metaphor, even like a Frankenstein approach to legislating, patching things on here and there just to try to avoid a crisis. Think back to debt limits or fiscal cliffs or government shutdowns, which did happen. Well, a week from today, John, next Thursday, government funding runs out on December 11th, and John Boehner is facing another government shutdown if he can't get the government funded and get him into 2015. The problem is a lot of Republicans, conservatives, don't want to vote for any plan to keep the government open, if it means funding, even for a day, President Obama's executive action on deportation. Listen to Congressman Steve King here. He's from Iowa. He's a major leader on the right when it comes to immigration policy.
I think they're going to have a difficult time reconciling their oath to the Constitution in a vote to fund lawless, unconstitutional act. I think they have to look in their own mirror. That's what I would say. But I think they know what my answer is.
Steve King is talking to Republicans there, John. Now, here's what John Boehner is trying to do. John Boehner's plan is to put a couple of bills on the floor. Today, they're going to have a bill on the floor that basically rebukes President Obama for the executive action, says, you can't do this. It's unconstitutional. We're going to snap you back on this, Mr. President. Now, a lot of people see that as purely symbolic. They know Harry Reid will never put it on the Senate floor. The president would never sign a rebuke to himself. So this is kind of a steam valve, if you want. John Boehner trying to let conservatives vent. And then after that, a funding bill to fund the entire government except the Department of Homeland Security. Now, the whole government would be funded for a year through 2015. Homeland Security only until February or January for a short period of time. A little bit of a bridge just to get you to the new year so that Republicans can have another confrontation with the president over executive action, except when they control the Congress. Now, it's one of these, like I said, Frankenstein approaches that the speaker has had to take over and over and over to try to get his conference to pass something and avoid a government shutdown that he thinks is going to make Republicans look terrible. I turn to Congressman Tom Cole. He's a friend of the show, John, been on the show a lot of times, Republican from Oklahoma, and a really close friend of Speaker Boehner's, about what he thinks is going on here, this sort of reprise of the movie that everybody's seen, John Boehner trying to run the House and avoid crises with Ted Cruz on his right criticizing his constitutional role. Listen.
I don't think anybody's more serious than John Boehner about his constitutional responsibilities, and I don't think he needs a lecture on them by any other member. But members are allowed, you know, to express their opinion, make their argument, make their point. Nothing wrong with that. But I think the speaker, you know, has to think of what's good for the entire conference and has to think about what's good for the entire body and for the country. I think that's what he's trying to do.
Not exactly a happy holiday season for Mr. Boehner in the House.
No, and it's got to be a little bit disappointing after the huge win that rocketed Republicans to control of the Congress in a big, big way, that the House Republican leadership is still fighting some of the old, old fights from the last couple of years.
Exactly. Thanks so much. Todd Zwilling, Takeaway Washington correspondent.
You bet, John.
Let's return now to the sobering reaction we've been seeing here in New York City to the grand jury's decision in the Eric Garner case. Last night, crowds thronged Rockefeller Center for the holiday tree lighting ceremony, and not far away, protesters shouted their outrage about the Garner case. Here are the sounds of that outrage and reaction as captured by our producing station, WNYC.
I can't breathe! I can't breathe!
I can't breathe!
This is not just about Eric Garner. It's about all of us. It's about our collective humanity and what we as Americans are passing on to the next generation of Americans.
I'm disgusted and embarrassed by our New York City government and NYPD.
I was doing everything peacefully, but it's gotten to the point where
you gotta keep the peace.
It's wrong.
I know.
We all are hurt.
It's like, where are we headed for? What's the future for me?
Your system got it right along with Eric Garner.
We want a public trial. We want a public trial.
When do we want it?
Now.
When do we want
justice?
When do we want it?
Now. People united will never be defeated.
The people united will never be defeated.
They didn't only fail
me. They fail many of us. And if we don't take care of this, they may fail you in the future.
Obviously, change doesn't happen overnight. Everything helps a little bit, but then, you know, something like this happens and just kind of sets everything back, you know, take one step forward, two steps back.
It just makes no sense that they would turn around and say no indictment. Even though with Mike Brown we were pissed, there was some question there. And people have a right to have questions. But this, you have the full video. So how can you not tell that this is wrong?
I'm a person here living in New York City all my life. My son, I raised him to do the best he could do. I don't want him walking down the street and being seen as a target for NYPD. Some kind of sporting, rabbit shooting kind of thing. I'm so angry and disgusted.
Find out how many cops got killed this year and put that in the news. You know, I'm not defending them. I know that maybe they could have handled it differently, but if they would just do what they're told, it wouldn't have happened. That's the way I feel.
I feel that, you know, with this whole race stuff going on now, that if it was, the guy was white and he was a white cop, that they wouldn't have blown this up as much as they did. I just think that because they're pulling this whole race card thing, I don't know, I'm not racist, so I don't see much of what everybody else sees with, you know, racist people, because I'm not racist. So.
It's important to find out what that person was really trying to do. In all fairness, we shouldn't turn someone into a monster.
The cops on Staten Island are equal opportunity guys. They pull us all over, they harass all of us. I never get a break from them.
The man's life was taken for misdemeanor action. For selling cigarettes, loose cigarettes, you're going to lose your life over that? Come on, it had to have been a better way.
It means people should respect the police officers even more so now, maybe out of fear, because it seems as we're becoming a police state.
I'm struggling because I'm also a father of two young African-American boys, and I don't know what to say to them about what's happening in this country right now.
Ways that we can come together in society and create change, and not allowing my anger and my emotions to get in the way of rationale and logical thinking.
From the streets of New York City, thanks to our producing partner WNYC, to voices across the nation.
So many of the facts that are clear, of course, because we have this video, you know, a chokehold, like in terms of what the legal instruction was, careless mistakes, that's exactly what negligent homicide is.
Let me say that I'm very disappointed with the grand jury verdict. However, I'm not surprised, and I don't feel that they made a wrong decision.
Call us with your reaction to the grand jury decision at 877-8-MY-TAKE. A view now of the civil war in Syria and the horrible chaos wreaked by ISIS in the region from across the border in Turkey. Journalist and author Robin Wright reports from Gaziantep, a Turkish city booming with military hardware, refugees, advisors, and all the signs of a war just 40 miles away. Wright says the war has changed the face of Turkey's border region, but hasn't made it more inclined to get directly involved in the conflict.
Southern Turkey is now the frontier for the war in Syria because so many embassies and aid organizations have abandoned Damascus. And so the United Nations, the U.S., most of the major NGOs such as Mercy Corps are operating out of Gaziantep. And with transferring goods, humanitarian goods, non-lethal military supplies into the rebel hell areas. The problem is, over the last year, that territory has diminished significantly. There were four provinces in northern Syria where the rebels had a major presence or control. ISIS took over two of them. The Nusra Front, which is affiliated with al-Qaeda, has taken off over much of a third province. And that leaves Little Aleppo, or actually Major Aleppo, the largest city in Syria, now threatened by the regime of President Assad. There are so many players, so many militias, so many armies fighting this war. It is today the most complex war in the last 100 years in the Middle East.
And does it have a sort of feel of like Peshawar in the old days in Afghanistan, in the sense that there's an arms market there? There are, you know, CIA and special ops people from various countries wandering around. It's become a culture of a military outpost.
Yes, Gaziantep is to Syria today what Peshawar in Pakistan was to the anti-Soviet effort during the 1980s, when the U.S. provided aid to the Mujahideen with help from some of the Gulf countries. That same scenario is now playing out in Gaziantep, where you have U.S. aid organizations flooding goods into northern Syria, but you also have this area where the Syrian interim government, the opposition forces, are now headquartered. And there are spies from all different kinds, whether it's the United States or ISIS. The problem in Gaziantep and all of southern Turkey is the influx of 1.6 million refugees. It's just stunning. Around Kobani, I went to four different refugee camps, and they're growing every day. In one refugee camp, I saw more than 3,000 people living in just over 400 tents.
How much of an investment is the U.S. making here? You saw the materiel and you described it a little bit, but this is not cheap, what the U.S. is attempting to do in this kind of rear guard action against ISIS from Turkey.
Well, the United States has invested just over $3 billion already on humanitarian aid, medicine, food, and other goods. There is another $90,000 for non-lethal military equipment, things like trucks and meals for the soldiers, the kind of totable meals that you can take to the battlefront. And then there's another $100 million in aid to the local councils inside Syria that are trying to govern in rebel-held areas, provide services such as garbage and medical services. For the international community, it's one of the greatest humanitarian challenges, really, since World War II. And the World Food Program just announced that they're going to have to cut off 1.7 million refugees in aid because they just don't have the funds from donor nations. You consider that half of the population of Syria, some more than 10 million people, are today either refugees in countries around the region or they're displaced inside the country.
I like the way you itemize what it is the U.S. is spending on military hardware. For instance, $58,000 an hour for a B-1 bomber, $39,000 an hour for an F-15E fighter, F-22 Raptor used in combat against ISIS in Syria, $350 million is what those F-22s cost. Again, I'm not saying that this is cheap or expensive, but it certainly indicates that we are all in here, even if there's no boots on the ground.
In Kobani alone, the United States and its allies have run over 300 airstrikes. And that's not accounting for all that we've done in Iraq and other places in Syria. And so far, the impact has had some effect in disrupting communication. The death toll among ISIS is reportedly in the hundreds now. But ISIS still holds more than 2 months later part of Little Kobani. It hasn't lost significant territory to the efforts either in Iraq or in Syria, that it's proven a pretty incorrigible enemy.
And you can see the flags everywhere from the Turkish side.
Yes, and that's one of the things that's so striking. Sitting on this hillside, watching this war play out with a lot of other refugees from Kobani who are with old binoculars looking at what's happening to their vegetable stands or their little homes. And you realize that the ISIS flag is still flying in the middle of Kobani. And the irony of all of this is that a lot of the equipment the United States is striking is actually American, whether it's tanks, artillery, military vehicles that the United States had given or sold to the Iraqi army. But when the Iraqi army disintegrated, ISIS quickly took that material and took a lot of it back to Syria. So it's one of those tragic ironies of the U.S. intervention, not just today, but of the last decade.
Robin Wright is a distinguished scholar at the Wilson Center in Washington and the U.S. Institute of Peace. She's also the author of Rock the Casbah, Rage and Rebellion Across the Islamic World. Her latest article in The New Yorker is called The Vortex. We conclude this hour with our continuing discussion of economic inequality in the world by noting that you can see that divide quite literally if you try to find maps. That's right. A map of Paris, Berlin, and Tokyo, no problem. You got your streets, you got everything. You got businesses, sights to see. But Grozny, Kisangani, Tokmok in Central Asia, or vast areas of Central Haiti, all you find are blanks if you can even find a map at all. This is not just about tourists. The era of big data has changed the field of cartography radically. But in political and economic terms, the value of a good, accurate map has never been more precious. Dave Imus is an artist and a traditional map maker who wants to empower Americans to improve their geographic knowledge by making high-quality maps. And Dale Kuntz is senior geospatial engineer at the American Red Cross, part of the Missing Maps Project, which aims to plot complete data on streets, rivers, and other geographical features around the world with the help of a global network of volunteers. Dale says crowdsourcing is one way the developing world can catch up and, quite literally, get on the map.
In the last 8 months, you know, we've worked really hard to put major cities of Freetown and Monrovia on the map. The cities that if you were to go look at in Google Maps or in Bing Maps or OpenStreetMap even before the event, before the Ebola outbreak, they were basically blank. There was no information about those places. Where now, if you go and look after the, you know, almost 3,000 volunteers have made almost 13 million edits, if you've looked at that, what the volunteers have been able to do, they've built out the fabric of these cities, and they've built out every building and every road and every stream and every land cover, all of that important sort of information that allows you to get an understanding of the geographic place that allows us to sort of fight Ebola a little bit better so that we see towns that we didn't know existed 2 weeks ago, so we can see their name on a map so that when somebody wanders in from a town to an Ebola treatment center and says, I'm from Borrio, we know where Borrio is, where 2 weeks ago we didn't know where it was.
So, Dave, from your perspective, looking on Google Maps, as entertaining as that can be, is actually more of a track of map literacy around the world than it is an actual map of the world. I mean, you can look at these blank places and think you're looking at something that's a map, but actually it's mostly a sign that, you know, modernism hasn't even reached that part of the world. How frustrating is that for you to look at if you scan Google Maps?
Well, I think I just accept Google Maps for what they are, and they're geared for people with money in their pocket who are traveling or, you know, looking for real estate or something like that. And I'm I guess frustrated at times with maps of that genre because I like to stray outside of the places that have shopping malls things, and their coverage really drops off rapidly.
You claim that the lack of maps in the United States has made us geographically illiterate. What would you do to correct that?
I think that if every social studies classroom in the United States had maps that were expressions of basic geography, maps that made geography observable and accessible to students, that we would develop into a country where people are aware of geography and their surroundings and where things are relative to each other. And once we get a handle on what the geography of our own country is, then perhaps we'll become more interested in what other people are doing around the world.
So is there a national pride element, Dale, to the development, to the investment that's required to make the kind of maps that Dave makes for a country like Kenya or Eritrea or Mali that doesn't have any of this data set down anywhere? If you could distribute maps of the place where people are, does it have a psychological effect on the entire country?
I think it has a huge psychological effect. And, you know, the program, the project that the Red Cross has started with Medicine Sans Frontières and the British Red Cross and Humanitarian OpenStreetMap team called Missing Maps is the idea that we want to instill that pride. We want to be able to get the community to sort of build the map themselves so that the data is free and open for anyone to use, so that if there's a Dave in Eritrea, that Dave from Eritrea can make a beautiful Eritrea map. That if local community members want to advocate on behalf of wanting more schools or a new evacuation center or whatever it may be, that they have the information there that they can sort of be more aware of their own geography or in their own context so that they can advocate for themselves and sort of in partnership with the Red Cross.
To deal with some of the poverty problems, though, and the development problems that exist in some of the places that you're thinking about, do we need somebody who maybe works a little faster than Dave?
We need thousands upon thousands of Daves. And that's where, you know, we do a lot of crowdsourcing and we do a lot of to be able to create that data. We're not in the places where we work. It's not as data rich as the United States. There is not a biennial census in most of the African countries. You know, some of the last censuses that were done in Africa were, you know, in the 1960s, the 1950s.
Wow.
So, I mean, so, you know, we end up doing for like Ebola, we want to know how many people live in a town. We have to map every building and then we make assumptions that, you know, maybe there's going to be three people in this town or four people per household in this town. So we know a basic population count because there is no census. There is no census tract. There is no census block group. That data just doesn't exist.
Dave, how trustworthy do you think crowdsourcing is in developing the data to even begin this process of making rudimentary maps where none exist?
I think it's a highly appropriate way to do it because you're gaining data from on the ground observation, which I think is infinitely more reliable than remotely sensed things, or you know, a geographer, somebody in Europe or the United States making a map of a place in Africa where they've never been has no chance of reflecting reality as accurately as a map that has been produced from data that was crowdsourced.
Dave Imus is credited with creating the greatest U.S. map ever made there in Eugene, Oregon, a real tangible map that has nothing to do with Google. Dave, thanks for doing that, by the way.
Hey, thanks, John.
And Dale Kuntz is working to fill in the blanks in the data-starved areas of the world. He's a senior geospatial engineer at the American Red Cross and is the U.S. lead for the Missing Maps Project. Dale, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm for getting rid of map inequality. That's right. How about you? What's your suggestion for dealing with the growing problem of income inequality around the world?
My name is Justin from Eugene, Oregon. I used to have the American dream, a wonderful income, 401k, profit sharing, benefits, healthcare, a beautiful home. Now I work a part-time minimum wage job. I do odd jobs and I ride a bicycle year round. I've never felt so depressed in all my life. And I'm thankful for what I have. But as far as bridging the gap between the rich and the poor goes, they'll have to die and leave us their money. That's all I can think of. I give anything for someone to see worth in me and give me a hand up, but I don't see that ever happening in this new gilded age.
Oh, man, Justin, I want to send you a turkey or something for the holidays. Lloyd writes on our website, when the 99% take out and use their pitchforks, they won't be killing the real culprits. The 1% hasn't caused the income inequality. They're just a convenient and easy scapegoat. Blame the rich fat cats. The actual cause is complex: globalization, mechanization, federal policy, and more. Join the conversation. Be a part of this program. Check us out at thetakeaway.org or call 877-8-MY-TAKE. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.